Welcome to Southern Living with Sun Sounds of Arizona, your volunteer reader. I will be reading from the Southern Living magazine, the April edition. This edition is focusing on the best of vacation, entertainment, local places to eat, all sorts of activities throughout the South, but this month is focused primarily on Alabama, best of, and the focus on Alabama addresses not only food and hotels, but also hospitality, places to visit, and history. Birmingham has a lot of history, and I am going to read an article today called The Church That Changed the World, and it was written by John Archibald. This is on Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church that still welcomes visitors with outstretched arms and a spirit of hope. So if you're ready to go, let's get going. Lisa McNair was born in the shadow of death. She arrived to Maxine and Chris McNair on September 19, 1964, 1 year and 4 days after Klansmen blew a hole in their church and an even bigger one in their lives. On a mild September Sunday, those bombers, enraged by the prospect of desegregation and whipped into a frenzy by local and state politicians, left the explosive equivalent of about 10 sticks of dynamite outside that church, below and just to the right of a stained glass window depicting Jesus holding a shepherd's crook. On the other side of that window, the Reverend John H. Cross previewed the morning's sermon entitled, quote, "A Love That Forgives," end quote, to a Sunday school class. The attackers had fashioned a rudimentary timing device from a fishing bobber in a leaky bucket of water. The liquid drained away at 10:22 on the morning of September 15, 1963. That flimsy bobber did its job and triggered the most deadly terrorist attack of the civil rights movement. Those men, none of whom would be tried in court for another decade and a half, murdered four girls: Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, Addie Mae Collins, and Denise McNair. Denise would be forever 11 to her little sister Lisa, but they would never meet. Addie Mae's younger sister, Sarah Collins Rudolph, was pulled alive from the rubble. Sylvester Norris drove the ambulance that rushed her, blinded by the blast, to the hospital. Rudolph was conscious, he told the police. He knew because she sang, "Jesus loves me, yes, Jesus loves me," on the way. The bombing changed those people, those families, forever. It jarred a city, a region, and a nation. When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke at the combined funeral, he talked about another dream of wringing good from evil so their deaths would not be in vain. Quote, "The spilled blood of these innocent girls may cause the whole citizenry of Birmingham to transform the negative extremes of a dark past into the positive extremes of a bright future," end quote, King said. Quote, "Indeed, this tragic event may cause the white South to come to terms with its conscience," end quote. The murders did, almost instantly, alter the way many people across the globe looked at racial violence. The crimes began to change the way the South saw itself, too. And who is really guilty? A white lawyer named Charles Morgan, Jr. famously asked in a speech at a downtown Birmingham civic club the day after the bombing. "We are a mass of intolerance and bigotry and stand indicted before our young," he said. "We are cursed by the failure of each of us to accept responsibility." McNair arrived in a world of conflict and grief. She was thrust by circumstances she didn't choose into a life directed by the death of a sister she would know only from pictures, stories, and news clips. She would fall into a role she never auditioned to play, but in time she learned to make it her own. Her most important part would be hope, a higher calling. Birmingham is a young city by Southern standards, a post-Civil War industrial boomtown forged by coal and steel and upheaval. It was founded in 1871, and only 2 years later, 16th Street Baptist was born. It was known at the time as the first colored Baptist church. From the start, it was a quiet symbol of persecution and persistence. The congregation raised money and in 1884 built a steepled sanctuary at its current location. According to the Reverend Arthur Price, who's been the church's pastor for the past 24 years, after the building was completed, the powers who ran the city declared that the steeple was too tall and demanded that the church be demolished. And so it was. The congregation raised more funds, and a black architect named Wallace Rayfield fashioned a new design in a modified Romanesque and Byzantine style. Construction began under the direction of a black contractor. It finally opened in 1911. The brick church stands today on that corner of 16th Street and 6th Avenue North in the heart of the Birmingham Civil Rights District. It appears, they say, much as it did in 1911. It certainly looks a lot like it did in the 1950s when many of the city's prominent black families prayed beneath a welcoming window depicting Christ as a shepherd during an era when they were unwelcome in restaurants, parks, and schools here. Across 6th Avenue today is the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute in the same block as the A.G. Gaston Motel, where King often stayed when he visited. Catty corner from the church is Kelly Ingram Park, now filled with statues commemorating the time in the spring of 1963 when police turned German shepherds and fire hoses on peaceful young protesters. Beyond that is the historic 4th Avenue Business District, where black shops and offices were largely relegated until the 1960s, and the Carver Theater, where black people could find entertainment without being forced into nosebleed seats. The three-block stretch is a history lesson, a time capsule, a shocking reminder of a past not so long ago, when it was illegal in cities like Birmingham for the races to mingle, to so much as dine together, when, quote, separate but equal, end quote, was the law, but separate but less was the reality. People seeking to understand history and how it affects the present make regular pilgrimages to this, quote, place of revolution and reconciliation, end quote, as a sign at the park now labels it. It is an emotional journey. As visitors look outward, they often find themselves looking inward. Over half of my group will stay in the church for 30 minutes, not talking, crying, says Jeff Steinberg, a Californian who has brought 1-2-3 tours totaling more than 210,000 people to Birmingham. And they're not thinking about the little girls. They're thinking about themselves and what their role is in all of this. I mean, it's quite powerful. A group of tourists from Germany came in the fall, as with those Steinberg brings here. They meditated in the church. They spoke in hushed tones as they wound through the sculpture path in Kelly Ingram Park beside bronze water cannons aimed at bronze children through a pack of bronze dogs, lunging with their bronze fangs bared. Inside the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, Carolyn McKinstry told them how the sanctuary at 16th Street shook that morning, how there was no carpet on the floor so the sound was deafening, how she hid beneath a pew until she heard footsteps running toward her. I was 15 years old, but I would be 15 for the next 20 years, she told that group. It took me that long to process it all. The attack on this church did not happen in a vacuum, and people are often stunned by the history. Birmingham saw dozens of bombings in the decades prior as the U.S. Supreme Court paved the way for desegregation of neighborhoods and schools. Threats to the church began in the spring of 1963 when demonstrators met there to organize protests and marches. Palm threats had been called in a number of times, including two on the Sunday before the blast. Police rarely, if ever, took them seriously. You can talk of the past until you're blue in the face, but it is when visitors sit in those pews beneath the surviving stained glass window that they begin to understand. It is when they hear from people like McNair, McKinstry, and Rudolph that they begin to feel. Todd Allen has brought tourists from across the country to see civil rights sites over the last quarter of a century, many of them to Birmingham. The buildings are powerful, but the people even more so, he said, describing how the city can't help but make visitors reassess their own lives and the way they greet each day. You know, sometimes we talk about it kind of in this abstract sense, particularly those of us who are tourists, Allen says. But then you sit with people like Lisa and Carolyn and see the ways they live out the daily that love, that forgiveness. I get mad even when somebody cuts me off in traffic. Yet those people whose friends and family members were killed, whose lives were shaped by racial violence, speak of the transformational power of love and reconciliation. To me, all of that comes out of that place and out of that space, Allen says. Reverend Cross never got to deliver his sermon from his pulpit on the day of the bombing. But in the chaos after the blast, amid the smoke and the sirens and the screaming, he picked up a megaphone and began to speak it. "Father, forgive them, because they know not what they do," he said. Born to comfort, McNair is blessed, or maybe cursed, with the kind of aura that makes people want to hug her. Strangers reach in all the time because they hear her story or know it, because they want to convey compassion, understanding, or sympathy. "May I hug you?" a man said as she was trying to leave a fall event at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. "I need a hug," said another. McNair dutifully embraced them both, not because they could make her feel better, but because from the moment she came into this world, she has shouldered the burden of putting the comfort of other people ahead of her own. Her parents badly wanted their first child, Denise, to have a little sister or brother. They tried and tried for more than 11 years without success. When Denise was killed that fall, Sunday in 1963, they were left childless again, and then a year and 4 days after her death, Lisa was born, healthy and happy, and ever herself. "When I first realized that, I was like, wow," McNair says, "all that time trying to have another baby and none survived. And then 1 year later, here I am. God is good." Another sister, Kimberly, would come in 1968, and McNair's parents would become known in Birmingham for their ability, despite their own searing pain, to reach across racial lines to forgive but never forget. It was a family made famous by tragedy, parents heartbroken but blessed, stuck between a world that wanted to remember and one that sought to forget. From the time of her birth, McNair gave comfort. "I was the child born after my parents lived through the murder of their only child," she says. "My goal in life was to make people happy. My pure existence getting here was to make these two people happy, so I couldn't be a bad child. I couldn't disobey. I couldn't do things that I wanted to do. They didn't even tell me that. I instinctively know what I know. I needed to keep it right because they had enough drama." Her great gift, perhaps it too is a burden, is putting people at ease as she talks about difficult things of making them comfortable being uncomfortable. "Some of my white friends tell me that," she says, "that I can say things in a way that doesn't make you feel like I'm beating up on you or that I'm mad at you or hate you. But to help you understand and feel comfortable, so then you're going to ask me questions. It's a conversation, you know?" They take their toll, the hugs and the talks, the cameras that were in her face as she mourned the deaths of her parents, the frustration of trying to preserve and share history as some politicians still seek to gloss over it. McNair spoke unsuccessfully before an Alabama legislature that wanted to limit how schools teach events, such as the bombing that killed her sister, lest white children feel guilt for the sins of their forebears. She has written a book, Dear Denise, and spoken countless times for tours and at tragic anniversaries. Allen always tries to remember that fact when he brings McNair and others to talk to visitors. "We're asking them to relive the most painful moment of their lives, and we disconnect that these are real human beings like you and me. They're not more than this moment, so I always remind people, even though we are talking about September 15th, 1963, that Lisa is more than this." You are listening to Southern Living Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am Leslie Hunt, your volunteer broadcaster. Onward with the article, Relentless Pursuit. When the bomb exploded in 1963, it hurled bricks like shrapnel across the street, crumpled cars, and blew through more than 2 feet of foundation, which collapsed onto the ladies' lounge where the girls had gathered. It killed four in the ladies' lounge. It killed four of them, and 18 other victims were taken to hospitals, including Rudolph, fellow church members, and two who had been passing by in cars. Yet that welcoming stained glass window survived, almost intact. Most of the panes remained. but the face of Jesus was blown to oblivion. Some called it a miracle, while others called it a message. People take what they want to take from it, Reverend Price says. Some believe the act was so horrendous that Christ couldn't look upon it. Others think the face was blown out because it wasn't about race. It's about God's grace that spared lives. We kind of let people leave it up to their own interpretation. Birmingham in 1963 was a place, like some others in the South, where segregation was enforced by terrorist violence and city code. Local leaders poured cement in the holes on golf courses rather than let them be integrated, and the governor ordered schools surrounded to keep out black students. King came to Birmingham that spring to use the city's own brutality against it. He, along with Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a local Baptist preacher who endured bombings and beatings in that quest for equality, held large meetings in black churches. 16th Street was prominent among them, though the congregation was initially skeptical. 16th Street was led into the civil rights movement kind of kicking and screaming, Price says. Dr. King convinced John Cross that 16th Street needed to lend its voice. It became the epicenter for the mass meetings. That came with consequences that shook the world. King, at the funeral for Denise, Cynthia, and Addie Mae, said their deaths called on all people to, quote, substitute courage for caution, end quote. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murderers, he said. Their death says to us that we must work passionately and unrelentingly to make the American dream a reality. Price revels in the history. The church, he says, is a sacred place of stability, of sacrifice, and survival. It is not a relic, but a living, breathing congregation. Our goal is to reach the lost and the lonely, the least of these, and rebuild those who are broken and battered and bruised, he says. He knows that part of the ministry is to teach history so the world will not forget it, to welcome pilgrims to this civil rights shrine. So last spring, the church broke ground on a 13,000-square-foot education and visitor center next door, which will have meeting rooms, a restaurant, and bathrooms where tired guests can freshen up. They will learn about the attack on the church and the reasons why protests are necessary in difficult times. They will be taught how former Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley sought justice in the case and finally convicted the first of the bombers 14 years after the crime, and how former Senator Doug Jones, while serving as a U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama, prosecuted the two other living perpetrators decades later. They will see the tenuous nature of progress. Quote, this new building addition will symbolize the movement from a dark past to a new light of hope and vision for the entire community, end quote, Price says on the architect's website describing this project. It is hard to stand inside the 16th Street Baptist Church and not feel a wash of emotion, anger at the bombers, at the community that looked away as violence grew, disappointment in humanity, in those who would kill rather than get to know those who are different from themselves, admiration for the congregation's strength to survive, wonder at those like McNair, a woman who has spent a lifetime trying to heal the wounds inflicted by white supremacists, but has devoted all she has to bridging seemingly unbridgeable gulfs. Fighting for the good, McNair's home is stuffed with family heirlooms, with images of black life captured by her father, a photographer, and later a state legislator and county commissioner. She has archived photos of civil rights heroes, of Jackie Robinson, of Shuttlesworth, of King leaving the Birmingham jail. Her father photographed everything, Rosa Parks and Dick Gregory, Angela Davis's wedding, Denise holding a white, blonde doll, Lisa and her sister Kimberly growing up, Denise in a casket. He even took one shot outside 16th Street Baptist Church when he was called to the site after the bombing on September 15, 1963, before he knew that his daughter had been murdered. McNair no longer attends 16th Street Baptist Church. More than two decades ago, she joined Dawson Memorial Baptist, a predominantly white church in the prosperous Birmingham suburb of Homewood. She had visited Dawson many times. It was familiar to her as she and her father had often watched its services on television as they prepared to go to their own church on Sunday mornings. She worried about what her family and friends would think. "I thought, oh my Lord, what are the people going to say if I go ahead and join this church?" McNair says. "I come from a civil rights legacy family. How am I going to just pop up and join a church with white people?" In the end, she felt welcomed by Dawson, surrounded by people who did not look like her, did not know enough about her story or the history that led to it, but needed to hear and were willing to listen. McNair made friends and sometimes has hard conversations with them. She finds in this day and age that many more of those are needed. Crossing barriers, building bridges, putting yourself in uncomfortable positions and conversations is hard, she says. But if you just sit back and leave things to chance, chances are not always good. I was born knowing that. White people killed my sister, so I've understood all my life that the world is not a good place at times, McNair says. But it's what we make it, and sometimes you have to fight for the good of it. And if you're not fighting for the good, the evil wins. End of story. Well, I'm going to switch gears now and go to our next article, the top 20 beach getaways. Sunny stretches of shoreline that delight visitors with much more than just sand and surf. This was written by Tara Masolin McKay, and she's talking about Golden Isles, Georgia. Time is imaginary here, says naturalist Kevin Reifenberg as he leads me on a paddle through Little St. Simon's Island's winding march. Snowy and great egrets swoop across the water and a gentle breeze rustles the golden-hued marsh's grass this region is said to be named for. As we make our way downstream, time does seem a bit more fluid, if not entirely made up, if you prefer to venture out on your own. On my last morning, I pedaled through a dense forest of palms and old-growth live oaks and then along open mud flats until I reached 7 miles of coastline. After some shelling and a dip in the ocean, I head back with just enough time to stop at Norm's Pond, one of LSSI's top birding spots before breakfast. I climb to the top of the wooden blind, and the first thing to catch my eye is a 9-foot alligator sunning not 15 yards away. I've hardly gotten over my luck when a sudden thrush catches my attention. I look up as a flock of blush-covered rosette spoonbills takes roost in a tree just across the water, their scarlet-painted wings flashing in the early morning sun. It's a sight that could easily have been plucked straight from the pages of National Geographic, but it's just part of the scenery here. End of story. But before the story ends, our author is giving us the list of the remaining 19 of Southern Living beach getaways out of the top 20. We've already talked about Golden Isles, Georgia, Orange Beach, Gulf Shores, Alabama, Destin, Florida, Hilton Head Island in South Carolina, Tybee Island, Georgia, South Padre Island, Texas, Isle of Palms, South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Sanibel Island, Florida, Anna Maria Island, Florida, Folly Beach, Florida. Number 12 is St. Augustine Beach, Florida, Siesta Key, Florida, Kiowa Island, South Carolina, Virginia Beach, Virginia, Pawleys Island, South Carolina, Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, Oak Island, North Carolina, Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and Panama City Beach, Florida. So that's the end of the list of the top beach getaways in the South. As the Southern Living Magazine April edition is dedicated this month, April, to the best of everything in the South. A spotlight on Birmingham started out with just the amazing history they have. It also has other articles on cooking, new restaurants, places to stay, you name it. Not just in Birmingham, But as I read more in the magazine and see the variety of offerings, it really gives a great picture of all the different southern states, what special places they have. There's history included. The most delicious food described. Can you tell I like to eat? And also, wonderful suggestions for out-of-the-way places and places to do things, walk, hike, swim, golf, all sorts of that. And so I will be bringing that up in our next shows. I look forward to exploring the South with y'all and looking and thinking about where I want to go next on vacation. I think I have got that planned already. So this is Leslie Hunt, your volunteer reader on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I hope I've read to you something of interest. Until next week, take care. Did you know if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. You can also take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Anyway, thank you for listening to our program this afternoon. We have more interesting programs on the way, so don't go away.